This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the news this week, daylight savings begins tomorrow, a sure sign that spring is just around the corner.
Ha!
But not before another major winter storm buries Boston and much of the state.
You know, we live in New England. This is a nuisance storm. It's not an emergency.
Also this week, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren continued her grilling of federal bank regulators, this time about HSBC's money laundering scandal.
How many billions of dollars do you have to launder for drug lords before someone will consider shutting down a financial institution like this?
From too big to fail to too big to jail.
Also, in the race to join Warren in the Senate, a new poll shows Congressman Ed Markey with a double-digit lead against all his opponents.
And a federal judge rejects the idea that Whitey Bulger had a federal license to kill.
He is saying that there is no way that any court, including his court, is ever going to allow someone to argue that they had permission to commit future crimes.
And Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez died this week, leaving behind a controversial legacy that included helping the poor in Venezuela and here.
Help is on the way. Millions of gallons of heating oil for needy families at 40% off. From our good friends in Venezuela, Citgo and Citizens Energy, your nonprofit energy company.
Those are some of this week's top stories we'll consider now with two capable members of our Week in Review team. Peter Canellos, editorial page editor with the Boston Globe, joins us. Good to have you, Peter.
Thank you, Anthony.
And David Boeri, senior reporter right here at WBUR. Thanks for coming in today, David. Good
You're
to
welcome,
see you.
You're welcome, Anthony.
So, well, as we mentioned, that spring may be just around the corner, but it sure feels like midwinter today. The storm, which is tapering off as we speak, dumped about 2 feet of snow across parts of the state, making the morning commute a big mess. Several thousand people across the state lost power. Schools were closed in many communities, but not in Boston. Here's Boston Public Schools spokesman Lee McGuire.
Working together with the City Public Works Department, we felt that we could have all of our schools open and ready to welcome students this morning.
Peter, let me come to you first. Were you surprised at all that the schools didn't cancel school today, given that it was a pretty heavy storm as I was driving in?
Yeah, I was surprised, and my street wasn't plowed as of 10 o'clock this morning, so I'm sure a lot of parents had a lot of problems. This was a very, very difficult storm to predict, and people were saying that all during the week. You heard people saying, well, it may be rain, it may be a lot of snow, it may not be a lot of snow, it's going to be tough to tell. And they obviously forecasters erred on the side of too little snow because it's become a much bigger storm than we expected. And I'm sure that Boston, whatever they say, the Boston schools officials were a little bit influenced by the optimistic forecast.
Harder, I guess, to make these predictions in this sort of late winter season. David, you were driving in today from points west. What did you see out
there?
I
saw slush, pools of water, and bad asphalt. But excuse me, did I just hear Governor Carefree, the same guy that shut down every road in Massachusetts a couple of weeks ago, say, stay calm, it's just a nuisance, it's just winter? Did I hear him say that?
I think that's what he said.
It wasn't bad coming in.
All right. Well, we're glad you made it, as I said. And you're looking kind of wintry as well there with that nice woolen sweater. So let's move on to news from the state's congressional delegation. And Senator Elizabeth Warren, she's been making good on her promise to hold federal banking regulators' feet to the fire. This week, she grilled officials from the Treasury, the Comptroller's Office, and the Fed on why they did not seek or recommend criminal charges against the bank HSBC, which is based in London, which paid $1.2 billion last December for a series of transgressions, including money laundering for Mexican drug cartels.
What does it take? How many billions of dollars do you have to launder for drug lords, and how many economic sanctions do you have to violate before someone will consider shutting down a financial institution like this? Mr. Cohen, can we start with you?
So Mr. Cohen is David Cohen. He's an undersecretary for terrorism and financial intelligence at the Treasury Department. Here's part of his answer.
We at the Treasury Department think don't have the authority to shut down a financial institution.
I understand that. I'm asking, in your opinion, you are the ones who are supposed to be the experts on money laundering. You work with everyone else, including the Department of Justice. In your opinion, how many billions of dollars do you have to launder for drug lords before somebody says we're shutting you down?
So tough questions. Last week, Warren questioned Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke about banks that are too big to fail. This week, it was all about banks that are apparently too big to jail. Peter, what do you make of her line of questioning? It's tough. Will it lead to real changes in the system? What do you think?
Well, I think Elizabeth Warren is discovering that the Senate can be a bully pulpit and that part of her power as a senator is just to raise these questions and to bring these issues to light. And I think that is a reason that a lot of people voted for her. They wanted to see the banks held more accountable. She certainly made no secret of the fact that this was a huge issue for her, and she's following up on it. So I don't think it's a surprise to anyone, except that we haven't seen a senator sort of using the Senate in this way in a long time, a freshman senator especially.
Yeah, really. It's fascinating. David, what's your view?
Well, I agree with Peter, and it's two freshman senators. What we're seeing, if you look at Washington this week, is the power of people standing up and asking tough questions and being unintimidated and speaking truth to power. She is on a tear. She's on fire, and she has them squirming. And she's unintimidated by the timidity of the administration in dealing with Wall Street. But what I especially love this week, when she's talking about HSBC, you know, that scandal, she has this understanding that if you treat people who snort green powder up their nose in the form of money the same way you treat people who snort white powder up their nose and treat them as criminals and send them to jail, you're going to get a hell of a lot more reform out of Wall Street than you're getting now with these regulators.
Interesting. I mean, it's interesting that you bring up the idea of snorting cocaine, because she made this point in this same line of questioning to the regulators. Let's just listen to this next piece of tape.
If you're caught with an ounce of cocaine, the chances are good you're going to go to jail. If it happens repeatedly, you may go to jail for the rest of your life. But evidently, if you launder nearly $1 billion for drug cartels and violate our international sanctions, your company pays a fine and you go home and sleep in your own bed at night. Every single individual associated with this. And I think that's fundamentally wrong.
And Peter, one of the sort of really troubling conclusions that came out of her line of questioning is that she's sort of pointing to a system here that seems to pass the buck. Treasury says it's not our job. It's up to the Justice Department. The Justice Department says, well, we only go to Treasury for advice, but apparently they don't get the kind of advice that would lead them toward making any kind of criminal convictions or charges. I mean, it does seem to be a system that just is all about passing the buck.
Well, it's a little bit hard to tell whether to blame the regulators themselves for not enforcing these rules very strongly, or whether Congress has written these rules in such a way that that really ties their hands. We're seeing this now with the Dodd-Frank protections that the SEC is writing these rules, but they're under intense pressure from particularly conservative members of Congress to try to make sure that the rules are written in such a way that discourages really sharp action against banks. And, there's also a genuine policy tension between punishing wrongdoers and inflicting a punishment that touches on innocent people, like the other people who've gotten loans from that bank or who are, working at that bank unknowingly, aren't aware that their colleagues are laundering money. So, there's probably some reasons for caution, but there's also some sense that Congress has intervened in a way that is too favorable towards banks, and that's what Elizabeth Warren's identifying.
But what Peter hasn't mentioned here is the White House itself, because this is a White House and it's the Democratic Party that's still under the influence of the Rubens, of the Tim Geithners of Wall Street here. And what's very interesting is that those two people from opposite sides of the aisle that are speaking here aren't part of the middle. Mm-hmm. They're part of the Tea Party, Rand Paul, and on the left, Elizabeth Warren, and they both are resonating because people want bankers and traders kept honest. And Paul has gotten a lot of attention and a lot of sympathy for what he's talking about, civil rights.
Well, let's move on. Let's stick with the Senate. We'll move on to that special Senate election race here in Massachusetts. A new poll out this week found that Congressman Ed Markey has a double-digit lead over all of his opponents. He leads the three Republicans. That's Gabriel Gomez, U.S. Attorney Michael Sullivan, and State Rep Dan Winslow by as much as 23%. And he leads his Democratic rival, Congressman Stephen Lynch, by almost 30 points. I know it's just one poll, but Peter, does this race seem like it's falling out of reach for anyone other than Ed Markey?
No, I think it's going to tighten up quite a bit, actually, and could be quite a competitive race. I do think that Markey brings a lot of very strong credentials into the race, and he, by virtue of his long tenure and the fact that he's been involved in a lot of high-profile legislation, he's pretty well known. So he definitely wins the name recognition war, and that's what this poll is reflecting. But I think it could easily be a tighter race as we go forward.
Mm. Well, let's talk about Stephen Lynch. Beyond that poll, this week he failed to secure what would be an important endorsement from the AFL-CIO, the state's largest union and the one he's been a lifelong member of. He also faced criticism for being the only member of the Massachusetts delegation who did not sign on to a brief asking the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the Defense of Marriage Act. How badly does this set him back, David?
You know, this is no surprise. It'll come as no surprise to people that he has moderate to conservative social views. He's also won a number of union endorsements that he wasn't expected to win. And I don't think that's a problem either. This is far too early. Neither of the candidates, they haven't debated yet. I think that counting him out at this point is a big mistake.
Hmm. Do you agree, Peter Kanellos?
Yes, absolutely I agree. I think that, you know, Lynch's appeal to people is going to be that he's against the establishment, he's his own man, Markey's part of the leadership in Washington, and that's definitely going to get some traction. Whether it'll get enough traction to push him to victory is another question, but this is going to be a more interesting race than it looks like right now.
You know, it's interesting, when he was on our show a little earlier this week, he mentioned the fact that if he were to be sent to the Senate, he would be the only former union member in the entire body. So an interesting thought in terms of what we were just hearing about regarding Elizabeth Warren's performance this week on various committees. But gentlemen, if we could move on, let's do so to the case of reputed Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger, who faces charges of multiple murders and federal racketeering. Now, this week, federal judge Richard Stearns dealt a major blow to Bulger's defense, ruling that he did not have a license to kill, undermining Bulger's claim that federal law enforcement officials had basically granted him immunity. So here's David Frank of Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly explaining Judge Stearns' decision.
He is saying that there is no way that any court, including his court, is ever going to allow someone to argue that they had permission to commit future crime.
So, David, let's start with you. Where does this leave Bulger in terms of his efforts to defend himself? Let's start there.
Let's start with you. Do you have any ideas for a defense magnate? They're looking for them. at this point, they are. They are looking for them. This is a devastating blow. We all knew going in, this is an outlandish argument that he had a license to kill. But the thought was, perhaps because of his Fifth Amendment rights not to incriminate himself, he could argue that he wanted to make this defense to the jury and not have to prove it to the judge. More concerning, though, is this extraordinary role that Richard Stearns is playing as a judge, because his status is not at all clear, hasn't been settled. We are close to a trial. The Court of Appeals hasn't decided. And there are people that will tell you privately and publicly that the best thing he could have done, the most public-minded service that Stearns could have done, was to walk away from this and to accept the fact that some people might wrongly believe that he couldn't be impartial, but he was going to do this for the sake of the system. He hasn't done that. He's been intransigent to the point of petulance now. He asked for arguments on this particular case that were due in last Friday. By Monday, he had made up his mind. It was stunning. He had made up his mind before we got the paper. So he has made himself the focus of this trial at this point, which is a real concern.
Now, Peter, I mean, as David mentioned, it's not very usual for a judge who it's not, you know, 100% certain whether or not he'll hear the actual case beginning several months from now, to be making all these pretrial motions. So, I mean, so what do you make of what David said, that Stearns is making himself the center of the story at the moment?
Well, I have a lot of respect for the opinion that David has and for the reporting that David has done about this issue. The issue being that Stearns himself had been part of the prosecutorial apparatus when Bulger received this deal from the FBI. There's no evidence that Stern knew about it, but since Bulger is trying to, you know, question the FBI and the Justice Department, you know, isn't that a conflict of interest for Stearns? And I think that it's an interesting issue, and it is playing out, and it does raise some questions about his role. I'm not sure that this particular decision was so controversial, though. I think most people would look at it and say, really? You know, forward-looking immunity? The Justice Department can say to you, go out and commit all the murders you want? I mean, yeah. It's not a...
That's true.
You know, this was not such a hard thing to parse when it came down to it. So I'd say the questions about Stern's role are legitimate, but this decision is not evidence of prosecutorial bias or the judge showing a bias towards one opinion.
My point, Peter, is more than he should have waited for the other business to be resolved. My greatest concern is at the end of the day that Bulger get a fair trial, because there's been so much awful stuff that's gone back here that's just drained the system of any confidence in the justice system, that you'd hope that everything is done right so that he's tried fairly. Mm.
David, how many more pretrial motions such as this are we expecting to see before June?
I think this was the major one we were expecting, and you know, we're going to find out. Now, the other part of this problem, by the way, is if he is in fact replaced, it's going to be much harder for another judge to reverse the decisions that Stearns has made.
Finally this week, let's talk a little bit briefly about the death of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. He died of cancer this week at the age of 58, 2 years after he was diagnosed. Chavez was a former paratroop commander, ally to Cuba's Fidel Castro, antagonist to the U.S., reelected 3 times. He survived a coup attempt supported by Washington. Even so, he was happy to sell the U.S. his oil. And in fact, Venezuela provided lots of discount oil to low-income folks across the U.S., through Citizens Energy, run by former Congressman Joe Kennedy.
I'm Joe Kennedy. If you need help staying warm, call me at Citizens Energy. We'll get you some heating oil at 40% off from the good people of Venezuela and Citgo. No one should be left out in the cold.
In a statement this week, Joe Kennedy offered his prayers to the president's family and said that the late Venezuelan president cared deeply about the poor, helped nearly 2 million Americans with heating assistance. Critics would say Chavez used the heating assistance program to sort of tweak the U.S. Peter, what do you think? How do we assess Chavez's complicated legacy, particularly in relationship to Joe Kennedy's effort to provide low-cost oil?
Well, I think everything that you said, and including the snippet from Joe Kennedy, is probably true. You know, mm-hmm. You can be a harsh anti-American critic. You can be an autocrat. You make a lot of disastrous economic decisions for your people. You can also support the notion of helping the poor. You can also help to bring education and health care to people. You can even donate oil that helps low-income people in the United States. It's a mixed legacy, and we should be able to, you know, accommodate some complication in our assessments of Hugo Chavez.
Complicated indeed. David.
Yeah. Peter, when was the last time you remember that Arabs were giving oil away to poor people in America? I don't remember that happening, even though we've been paying money to the Arabs that we know in the past was being sent to fundamentalist jihadists. And we always celebrate in our foreign policy the Arabs' commitment to peace and security. There's something hypocritical about that. And even now, what, 60 years later after President Kennedy's, 50 years after the Alliance for Progress, we still seem to get very, very uptight when South American governments show some independence or liberal or leftist tendencies. Here, clearly an autocrat in many ways, but there is another case to be made for him.
All right. Well, that brings us with just enough time to go through our hubbubs, those stories that perhaps didn't rise above the fold this week. Magna, let's come to you for your hubbub.
So mine is one that actually just popped up today, I believe, and that has to do with Downtown Crossing and the fact that there's been a lot of changes going on there, some much, much slower than the city might have desired. But apparently the Downtown Boston Business Improvement District at the end of the month is kicking out all the push carts, the 26 vendors down there at Downtown Crossing. And when I mentioned this in the staff today, one of our producers immediately said, oh, the peanut guy, the nut guy, what's going to happen to him?
It ain't so.
But basically, representatives have said that, you know, vendors have always been a staple of Downtown Crossing, but with the slow change in the neighborhood there, the carts and the merchandise they sell needs to be upgraded if the area is going to be improved. And that's what kind of, rubbed me the wrong way, because, you know, you can gentrify a neighborhood, but do you necessarily need to gentrify the knockoff handbag seller guy? And those guys have been there for a long, long time, and they are being unceremoniously dumped from Downtown Crossing. So that's my hubbub for today.
All right. David, let's go to you.
I think it's time for a shout out for the human anatomy, especially for bladders and spines this week. Because in Washington this week, a bladder stood up for constitutional civil liberties and took on a president who was a constitutional scholar but now abrogates for himself the right to decide whether he can kill Americans in a foreign soil. And that without due process. So here Ron Paul gets up and he speaks. Democrats, remember, have this been George Bush, they would have been squealing like stuck pigs. We did not see spine from the Democrats except for Ron Wyden. But meanwhile, Paul persisted for 13 hours. He got a statement out of the administration. He got people all in a fury again. And finally, for an aging guy like me to behold a guy with 13-hour bladder capacity.
So this is all about...
I salute him. Bladder capacity and spine in the pursuit of civil liberties.
He's a doctor,
it's an amazing performance.
I was going to say it might have something to do with political principle, but you want to focus on bladder control. Okay.
In the pursuit of democratic ideals.
Peter Kanellis, let me come to you.
I hate to disappoint David, but I think he had some people standing in for him during the 13 hours. It may not be the feat of control that you're imagining, but I was going to mention the 2,400 snow removal tickets that the city has put out dealing with the blizzard that we had a few weeks ago, and no doubt there'll be a lot more with today's snow. I hate these kinds of tickets. It's just such an intrusion to be, you know, scolded by the city that you haven't done something. But on the other hand, it's a good lesson for people to learn that you should get out there and shovel, or make sure, not if you're older or have medical problems. I mean, you know, make sure that somebody shovels the walk outside of your home or business, because there are many injuries that people can suffer on the icy sidewalk.
Absolutely. So here's my hubbub. It's the smackdown between the satirical website The Onion and your paper, The Boston Globe, Peter. So The Onion started it this week with a piece that suggests Boston is something less than a major American city, with a piece that it headlined, "Pretty Cute Watching Boston Residents Play Daily Game of Big City." I'm just going to read the first paragraph. "Boston residents once again hustled and bustled their way into the nation's hearts this week as they continued playing their adorable little game of Big City, a live-action role-playing adventure in which Bostonians buzz about their daily routines in a delightful hubbub of excitement as if they lived in a major American metropolis." I don't know where they get this stuff. anyway, they go on a little bit. They go, "Boston residents are particularly endearing when they get all dressed up for night at the theater, eat at big fancy dinner at the Prudential Center, and read the Boston Globe, whose reporters get to play a game of big city journalists each and every day." Well, not to be outdone, the Boston Globe fired back. It was a great piece. In a big city newspaper exclusive, the Boston Globe today uncovered evidence that The Onion, a website that claims to be America's finest news source, is in fact not a legitimate news source, but a website full of satire and fake news. And it goes on, and it's wicked funny. And we've provided links to both those pieces at radioboston.org. So there's my hubbub for the weekend.
Peter, was that a Spotlight team investigation?
No, it was a culture blog piece. We'll allude to it in editorial tomorrow, though.
All right. Peter Kanellis, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. And David Boeri, WBUR senior reporter, always good to have you in. And
same here.
Drive safely back.
Thanks a lot. Have a good weekend.
All right.
Well, stick with us, because coming up, Top Chef winner, Kristen Kish. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.